Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories. You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. The state Senate this afternoon is expected to approve a bill to restore $28 million to high school career and technical education programs known as Joint Technical Education Districts, or JTEDs. Without the bill, which the House has already okayed, these programs would see a $30 million cut this year. The Senate was supposed to vote on the bill yesterday, but held off after Governor Doug Ducey expressed concern. He says career and technical education programs are important, but the spending has to be seen in context.
I'm also concerned about a balanced budget, and I like to think of the budget as a total package, and career and technical training and JTEDs will be a part of that.
51 of the legislature's 90 members have signed on as prime sponsors of the bill. The House approved it on a 58-0 vote. The governor now says he'll sign it. The bill also includes some additional oversight, including a task force to make sure there's uniformity in course offerings and certifications, among other things. A few weeks ago, we heard from Jeremy Plum, superintendent of Mountain Institute JTED in Prescott, about how those $30 million in cuts would affect his program. Today, with those cuts on the verge of being reversed, he joins me again. And Jeremy, is this a good deal in your mind?
I think it's a great deal, Mark. As compared to a $30 million cut, it is a very good deal.
Obviously, the money is important, but are you okay with some of the oversight provisions that this bill also includes?
You know, Mark, we had a lot of conversation over the last 2 to 3 weeks about some of those oversight provisions. There are some provisions that are going to be very new to the JTED world, and we're all still trying to get our arms around the impact of some of those provisions. Many others in the document we actually recommended to legislative council and staff that we think would help with transparency of the JTEDs overall and help, if you will, take some of the target off our backs for future years. As you know, we've been through 5 straight years of budget reductions from the state, and our hope was in creating a system that is much more amicable to everybody involved, much more transparent, and that really meets the needs of both the legislature, the governor's office, and the JTEDs.
Which are the provisions that you're going to have to get used to?
Well, I think there's some of the changes in the law will be very different from the way the business has operated in the past, such as the task force will be a new and welcomed, I should say, process to the JTED world. Some of the items listed underneath that task force, such as common course names and titles, we think is a great idea and will bring uniformity across the state. However, that is something that is very different. Of the 14 JTEDs that exist today, we're all built very differently. And so getting to a point where we're standardized in some of those provisions is going to take some time. It's going to take a lot of thought.
You referenced the several years of cuts that JTEDs have been going through, and this $28 million represents almost a complete reversal of cuts that were scheduled to go into effect this year. How much does this do for you? How much will you be able to do that maybe you wouldn't have been able to do without this, considering all of the other cuts that have come before this one?
Well, Mark, the opinion of the JTED group as a whole has been through this whole process that the restoration of the $30 million that we're going to see with this bill today will allow us to preserve what we already have in place. It's not going to replace the cuts that we saw in 2011 from the freshmen or any of the other budgetary reductions that have occurred over the last 3 or 4 years. But we knew going into this discussion that we had to live to fight another day, that we knew that we had to preserve the existence of the JTED as a whole, and this $30 million does that. It allows us to maintain the level of functionality that we were at in 2015 and prior. We were able to withstand some of those other cuts, even though we still feel today the impact of those. And our hopes are that as the state economy continues to improve, that we will be able to go back and work with legislative leadership to reinstate some of those cuts that happened to us in previous years.
Jeremy Plum is superintendent of the Mountain Institute JTED in Prescott. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
Tempe is moving the water out of its town lake and into SRP's canal system. The city has to replace the lake's dam and will take about 35 days to get all the water out. It should be gone by March 15th. Joining me to talk more about this is Eric Kaminsky, the water resource manager for Tempe's water utilities. Eric, what exactly are you doing and how are you doing it?
This particular agreement with between SRP and Tempe is about 30 plus years old. It's called the Water Delivery and Use Agreement, and it does have water exchange provisions in it. So this is basically just a letter agreement between the authorized representatives for Tempe and SRP to provide for water exchanges, which we do every year, only in this case, it's a little bigger circumstance. How we're achieving it is there are four pumps up to about 3,000 gallons per minute each on the north bank of the lake, about midway between the marina on the north side and Mill Avenue Bridge. And from that point, the pumps direct into two 18-inch pipelines that go underneath the 202 underpass, then turn west along an old SRP lateral canal. And at the terminus of that ditch, where it goes into an underground culvert, which daylights in the Grand Canal, just several hundred feet further to the west, that's where the water from the lake discharges to SRP's system, and then they're using it downstream for water deliveries to SRP shareholders and customers.
Why is it bigger this year?
Well, we've never had to move water from the lake on a scale like this before. The reason we're doing this right now and doing this water exchange, for one, is that we can actually utilize the exchange water credits to refill the lake at a time that probably about mid-April when the new dams are tested. And the reason why we have to move water from the lake right now is the older rubber bladder dams that are still in place need to be unbolted and removed and then taken off-site before the new dams can be fully commissioned.
So will people who walk or ride their bikes or walk their dogs along SRP's canals notice that the water levels are higher now than they would be otherwise?
No, if you're going along the Grand Canal, it's just the fact that the water deliveries would be there from a different source.
And you mentioned water credits, so presumably later this spring when the new dam is in place and ready to go, you want water back in Tempe Town Lake. Where do you get it from, and how will it get there?
Okay, so when we're taking water, in this case, it's generally Central Arizona Project, Colorado River Water, that Tempe used to supply Town Lake over the past year or so. We're taking that water and putting it into the SRP system as part of the exchange, and we'll get the one-to-one credit for that amount of water. When we're ready to take back water credits to fill the lake, that'll come from SRP's canal system and reservoir system.
Is it fair to say that you're basically loaning SRP this water for a few months and then taking it back when the lake is ready to be refilled?
Yes, that's exactly how the water exchanges work.
How long will it take to refill the lake once you're ready to do that?
Well, that's going to depend on exactly what the flow rate is that we can get from the SRP system. In 2010, when we had failure of the rubber dam, and then the replacement dams were installed, we filled the lake in about two to two and a half weeks in October. So that's probably the shorter window. So it's probably anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks total.
Eric Kaminsky is Water Resource Manager for Tempe's Water Utilities. The city is projecting the lake will reopen on April 30th. A report from the State Education Department's Educator Retention and Recruitment Task Force says a, quote, severe shortage of effective teachers continues to lead the list of critical issues impacting their work. The panel also offers some recommendations to policymakers, parents, and community members, chief among them, perhaps not surprisingly, paying teachers more. Joining me to talk about the report and its recommendations is Erin Hart, Chief Operating Officer for the education group Expect More Arizona. She's also a member of the task force. Erin, we've been hearing about a teacher shortage in Arizona for some time. How bad is it right now?
Well, a recent poll that was conducted earlier this year showed that there were more than 1,200 vacancies in Arizona classrooms across the state, and that was just a subset of Arizona schools. So we do have a teacher crisis in Arizona.
So given what you found as far as the number of vacancies in that subset of schools that answered the survey, is that better than before? Is it worse than before? Is it right around where we've been?
I would say it's getting worse. Unfortunately, I think there are a lot of good things that are happening to help with this issue, but I think right now we're seeing it possibly at its peak.
So one of the things that we hear about a lot is teacher pay, and it makes sense that if you pay a teacher more, they might be more willing to stick it out in the classroom.
Yeah.
In your mind, is that the top thing that the state needs to do to try to retain the teachers it has and recruit more teachers to come here?
Well, that's certainly one piece of it, and it's a very important piece of it. There are other pieces, too, that, you know, when you talk to teachers about this issue, and data confirms that it's about pay, it's about working conditions, it's about how they feel respected, it's about them having access to resources and support that they need to be successful in their job. So it's a bigger picture than just funding.
But some of those other factors also include funding, right? I mean, if there are resources and mentoring programs, another report mentioned, and those all cost something, too. So even if the money isn't necessarily going directly into a teacher's paycheck, it's still money that has to come from somewhere to make some of these other things happen, right?
Yeah, funding certainly isn't the silver bullet, but it is so important to be able to attract and retain and keep teachers, and then to give them the support that they need. They need, you know, coaching, great professional development. They need opportunities to grow and learn and be the best in their profession that they can be.
So how do we do that?
Well, there are lots of great things that are happening in this regard. So we can look at expanding those best practices and scaling them up a little bit more. Some things like the K-12 Center's Master Teacher Program and National Board Certification Programs are giving teachers ways to plug in and learn more and to, you know, grow in their profession. There are other school districts who have great mentoring and induction programs to coach and mentor new teachers. So the more we can focus on those kind of strategies, the better.
How optimistic are you that the funding piece of it will ultimately come through, whether it be from Proposition 123, if voters approve that, or some other way?
Well, I think we should be hopeful. I think we need a long-term sustainable funding solution for Arizona education overall, and that's from the early years through college and career. And so, you know, that probably means 123. It means looking at the Proposition 301 and renewing that and updating it in the future.
That's the school inflation funding formula.
Yeah. And right now, that's putting in about $600 million annually into Arizona education, into classrooms. So that's going to expire in a few years. So we'll need to look at renewing that and updating that and getting that discussion going again. I think we should be hopeful, but we know we also have a lot of work to do to get there.
Yeah, I mean, in the current fiscal and budgeting climate, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of sort of extra money being proposed for programs like mentoring programs or additional certification or professional development. Are you finding that districts sort of have to shift money around in their own budgets to make some of those things happen?
Yeah, I think districts are doing the best that they can, and they're trying to leverage private dollars where they can, whether it's a grant or something that they apply for and they can be a part of it. And yeah, they're leveraging their existing dollars too. I think there's more of an over-reliance now on bonds and overrides because those are local sources of funding because the state's funding has decreased so much. So a lot of school districts are able to leverage those to be able to use them in their communities.
Erin Hart is Chief Operating Officer for Expect More Arizona and a member of the Educator Retention and Recruitment Task Force. Erin, thank you.
You're welcome.
William Shakespeare died 400 years ago, but based on films, TV, and yes, school plays, his influence is still being felt. This month, one of Shakespeare's first folios is in Arizona. A couple of hundred still exist around the world from their creation in 1623. To learn more, I'm joined by ASU professor and Shakespeare scholar Ian Moulton. Ian, what is in the first folio?
Now, the folio is a technical term. A folio means the easiest way to understand it is a folio is a very big book. It's like the kind of Bible that you'd have sitting on a table in a church. Mm. It's not a pocketbook. It's not something to carry around with you. It's to read on a table in a library or at your house. It's very expensive and it's built to last. Because Shakespeare didn't care about publishing his plays during his lifetime, if there had not been a first folio, we would not have 18 of his plays, including Antony and Cleopatra, As You Like It, Julius Caesar, Macbeth, Measure for Measure, The Tempest, Twelfth Night, and The Winter's Tale.
What's the significance of it to people who may in fact have just minimal interest in Shakespeare? Perhaps they've seen a son, a daughter in Romeo and Juliet, for example. They don't know much about it. What can we learn from Shakespeare from the first folio?
It shows just how important Shakespeare was seen to be by his fellow actors. Folios were very expensive things, and they were very seldom published. Less than a third of surviving books are folios, much fewer for later periods. Just like now, you publish a lot of paperbacks. You don't publish a lot of these big sort of authoritative books. And the main kind of book that would have appeared in a folio was the Bible. 8 years before Shakespeare's folio came out, Shakespeare's fellow dramatist Ben Jonson published his works in a folio edition. Jonson was alive when he did this, and it was very much a sort of marketing and career move on his part. And he was mocked for it. People said, you know, Ben, you've published this big book called Jonson's Works. I thought you wrote plays. Plays aren't works. Plays are plays. Plays are frivolous. Plays are not something that lasts. A work is something serious like the king would write. So the fact that Shakespeare's plays were published as works, you know, 7 years after his death, and as far as we know, he wasn't mocked for this. People thought it was appropriate. The folio sold. Probably, if there had been no folio, Shakespeare wouldn't have the cultural position he has today for us, because he would have been a writer who published some cool plays, but they weren't published in a big sort of built-to-last volume that insisted the writings in this book are really, really important.
How is it, and why is it, that Shakespeare is still relevant in the U.S. today? Is he relevant in non-English-speaking countries 400 years later?
Shakespeare is very much part of German culture, for example. They refer to him as Unser Shakespeare, our Shakespeare. Shakespeare is very popular in Japan. There have been several great Japanese films made of Shakespearean plays, adaptations taking the stories and putting them in a Japanese context. Shakespeare is performed in India and really all over the world in various ways and adaptations. And I think part of this is because Shakespeare, we think of Shakespeare as sort of high culture and high art, and a lot of people are a little nervous about Shakespeare. He's very fancy. But for Shakespeare himself, in his own life, he was producing popular culture as much as he was producing high culture. The plays that he put on were intended for all people. They were not just being performed for a sort of educated audience of wealthy people or the elite or the court. And the stories that Shakespeare chose to dramatize are very exciting stories, and they involve sort of fundamental human issues, like how do you deal with the death of a parent, or what are the dangers associated with ambition.
Professor Ian Moulton of the School of Letters and Sciences at ASU, we've been talking about Shakespeare's first folio in Arizona. Professor, thanks.
Thank you.
For children diagnosed with autism, school can be a difficult place. They're often isolated and bullied. Some have been lost on the streets after wandering away from school. Parents of autistic children worry about untrained school staff and overcrowded classrooms. But one charter school in Arizona is changing that. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger takes us to one of their classrooms.
Ready to rock?
Ready to roll.
Megan Tolway's fourth and fifth grade class is busy playing a Pokemon card game a few minutes before the bell on a Friday afternoon.
I'm going to pause your Pokemon game, and I appreciate you being flexible for a couple minutes. Really quick, I want to talk about our Valentine's Day party next Friday.
They are full of ideas.
We could maybe have heart-shaped marshmallows.
But this isn't just any classroom.
The idea I have is we could go for a certain theme.
This is the Arizona Autism Charter School, and Tolway's class is full of high-functioning children diagnosed with autism.
I get students that are able to communicate pretty effectively. They're able to attack regular schoolwork, but they're really looking to expand on their social skills, learn how to cope when they lose a game, or how to kind of maintain authentic friendships past that superficial level of just saying hi.
Everything from the class size to the teaching style to the curriculum itself is geared toward helping kids like these learn and grow in the classroom.
If they need to take a break, we have the space to take a break so that they can come back and be successful instead of it ruining their whole day.
The charter school is a godsend to many parents whose autistic children have struggled in other schools for years, according to the school's executive director and founder, Diana Diaz Harrison.
I really understand their struggle and how hard it is to, you know, drop your child off at school every day and not know what's going on, or if the teachers are trained, or if they even know what autism is.
She understands because her own son, Sammy, was diagnosed with autism when he was just 2 years old.
So that just changed my whole life path completely.
Her son is severely affected by his autism, Diaz Harrison said. He's nonverbal, and when he reached school age, it was a challenge.
He did regress, and the teachers didn't understand how to relate to him.
So she decided to do something about it. She went through the Arizona Charter Schools Association's program to obtain approval from the state, and in 2014, opened the school herself. Sammy enrolled in the fourth grade.
One in 64 Arizona children are affected by autism. This is a state where kids are more highly affected than other states. So this is a growing need. There really should be more schools that are specialized.
This is a math class, you said?
What do we need to do? Takeaway 5, ready?
The school serves kids on all levels of the autism spectrum, high-functioning kids like these first graders, and students who are nonverbal.
They come here and we've watched them speak their first words, and that is priceless. That will make us work as hard as possible to help as many kids as we can.
And now they're expanding to help more kids, 108 to be exact. The K-5 school just got state approval to enroll students through 8th grade.
Edwin, what does it say?
10 takeaway 1.
But they currently have a waiting list of more than 100 kids, Diaz-Harrison said. And to maintain their student-to-teacher ratio and keep well-trained teachers in their classrooms, they can only expand so quickly.
All right, thanks, guys. I like all those ideas.
Back in Tolway's classroom...
Thank you for being flexible. You guys can go back onto your Pokemon card.
The kids are back to their game.
Use Helix Force.
Tolway says when it comes to her students, there's one thing she thinks about all the time. What if they had never come here?
These are kids who did not have friendships before they came to the school, and they have true friendships. They go to birthday parties, they hang out on the weekends, they call and text each other. So when you look at quality of life, that's everything. And they feel good about themselves here.
In Phoenix, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
ASU Libraries this week released 4,500 photos taken in and around Phoenix between 1884 and 1947 by two brothers from Scotland. Most of the photos, though, were from between 1930 and 47. Rob Spindler is the head of archives and special collections for the ASU Libraries. And Rob, what do we learn about Phoenix and the region from these photos?
It's a really important collection because the material predates the boom period of growth and post-war period after World War II. When you look at population figures for Phoenix, we were about 65,000 people in 1940 and then well over 100,000 in 1950 and then 400,000 by 1960. So it really tells us a story of what the appearance of this little town was in the 1930s, what people did for a living, how they worked, what they did for social activities. And so it tells the story of a small town in the Southwest that's just on the cusp of a major growth period.
Kind of the calm before the population boom storm.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of thinking about it because it was a calm place back then. And we hadn't seen the post-war growth yet and the real industrialism that occurred after World War II. So very much an agricultural community with a small population center in Phoenix.
The photographs were taken by two Scottish immigrants to Phoenix. Is there anything significant about the fact that the point of view that we're seeing is not from Phoenix natives necessarily or even American natives, but folks who have come here from somewhere else?
I think it's an interesting idea. The McCulloughs had an eye for events and places that most people might not, and they went to the desert and took photographs, things that people who lived here saw every day, but they saw the special wonder of the desert. They saw the beginnings of industrialism, the mining, attempts to control and manage water supply. And so this was all very new to them and fresh, and they were able to bring their lens to those topics and events in a way that perhaps a local person might not have.
In looking through the photographs, have you seen or learned anything that was surprising to you?
Well, I was surprised at how much of the photography dealt with things like the Frog Tanks Diversion Dam and other water control efforts, the early photography of Roosevelt Dam, for example. These were relatively isolated places back then, and so James and William McCullough made a significant effort to get out there and take those photographs. This is very heavy camera equipment. Many of the early photos in the collection are glass plate negatives, and so you can imagine the logistical difficulty of actually taking your gear out there and setting it up and capturing these great images in some fairly remote places in the what became the Phoenix metro area.
When you go through the photographs, does it help in any way, do you think, explain what is going on today, how the city is sort of laid out and how it works today?
Well, it's a bit challenging because the McCulloughs did not make a lot of street scenes that or aerial photographs that give a perspective on the development. I think it's much more about daily life on the streets of Phoenix at specific events and places, but it's hard to see the development on a grand scale. You do see familiar places that are presented as desert landscapes that are now fully developed, but it's hard to really get the perspective for growth from these photographs.
Rob Spindler is head of Archives and Special Collections at Arizona State University Libraries. Rob, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And we'll post a link so you can see the photos for yourself at theshow.kjzz.org. You are listening to The Show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Jody McPherson, and I am learning to be a grill master.
The potatoes and apples are done, and I'm pulling the squash off right now.
At the beginning of this class, I could barbecue hot dogs and hamburgers very well.
All right, I think they're ready.
That's good. To face him a little more to that side. That's a little more where the height heat's at.
Now I feel I've branched out. I can do ribs, briskets, I can do some veggies, and be very confident they're gonna come out and people are gonna enjoy them.
Look at that, you guys.
That was awesome.
Super Bowl, Memorial, Labor Day, 4th of July. They're going to call me and say, can you do this for me?
That's Jody McPherson taking a barbecue cooking class at Phoenix BBQ and Grilling School. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to rake us over the coals, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. It's The Show on KJZZ for Thursday, February 11th. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And along with The Takeaways' John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. Despite the news today from Russian officials that Russia is ready to discuss a possible ceasefire in Syria, tens of thousands of Syrian refugees are amassing at the Turkish border, fleeing the latest battle in Aleppo.
Turkey has sealed its border, and the refugees say there is no way to endure a major government offensive backed by Russian airstrikes. The airstrikes come as forces try to retake Aleppo after years of being divided between government and rebel control.
According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, at least 500 people, including 89 civilians, have been killed, and refugees continue to flee. Joshua Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He says the U.S. may have to accept that this is Vladimir Putin's approach to dealing with ISIS. Reinstall dictator Bashar al-Assad's control of all of Syria.
This leaves us in a terrible dilemma. Do you, in a sense, let the Russians try to reinstall Bashar al-Assad, the dictator? Or do we try to continue to build up moderates to conquer both Assad and the extremists, ISIS and al-Qaeda, which we've been doing for 5 years and have failed? That's the dilemma.
To be cynical, to be cynical though, Joshua. I mean, we've had our own, relationships with dictators in the Middle East going back in history and other places in the world. Is it conceivable that Putin is actually right, that the only way to defeat ISIS is to reinstall this brutal dictatorship in Syria, and we'll worry about the consequences of that later?
Well, we've made that decision in Egypt, in a sense, by backing Sisi. We support the monarchies in Saudi Arabia. There are many dictators and authoritarian regimes that we support. Of course, Bashar al-Assad is particularly distasteful. This war has been so brutal. But Putin may be right. Maybe the Middle East is not ready for democracy. Maybe Syria is too fragmented. There are too many different minorities, and that it can't bind together.
Meanwhile, 50,000 Syrian refugees from Aleppo are banging their heads against a sealed Turkish border. what's to become of them.
It's true, John, but you, look at what we're doing in Iraq. We just took Ramadi. That city was bombed to smithereens. There is no house left standing. The reports that came out of that city, it's worse than Aleppo. And that's America doing it. And Russia is doing almost the identical thing we're doing in Iraq. We are supporting a very sectarian Shiite regime to destroy Sunni rebel life in Iraq. Russia says, I'm going to do the same thing in Syria. Of course, there's a big difference. Shiites in Iraq are 60% of the population. So destroying the minority, the religious minority, seems not so bad. Whereas in Syria, the Alawites are about 12%. The other religious minorities, Christians and so forth, make only maybe 23% if you add them all up. There's Kurds, another 10%. But the Sunni Arab Muslims are 70% of Syria. Unfortunately, we have failed to produce power sharing. And there's ethnic rebalancing going on in both of these countries. And it's a scary sight to behold. You know, I've compared it to what happened in World War II, where all of the new nations of Eastern Europe exploded into ethnic conflict. Poland was 64% Poles before World War II. It was 100% Polish at the end of World War II. There were not only 6 million Jews exterminated, but 12 million Germans from Central Europe were ethnically cleansed at the end of the war. They were the guilty minority. The Sudeten Germans, 3 million, pushed out into Berlin. And America was overseeing that. So this, in a sense, great sorting out that took place in Central Europe during World War II, where the borders weren't changed to fit the ethnicities, the people were changed to fit the borders. That same process, that same great sorting out, is taking place in Iraq and Syria today.
Joshua Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Joshua, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
Arizona is full of ghost towns, spots that were once kept alive by mining or the railroad that have pretty much blown away in the desert wind. But a few of these hidden historic communities have survived, including one not far from Phoenix that's still got a good place to get a drink. KJZZ's Dina Sieg reports.
It's called Cleater, and if you've never heard of it, don't feel bad. This collection of old, ramshackle buildings is only a 70-mile drive from Phoenix, but it's tucked so far into the desert, you gotta be looking hard to find it, which apparently many thirsty people are.
Cleater is the halfway point between civilization and paradise.
Bill McMaster is sitting at the Cleater Bar, officially called the Cleater Bar and Yacht Club, complete with old boats, buoys, and jet skis out back. But inside, this place is Old West through and through, with a creaking wooden floor and walls so heavy with cowboy memorabilia, it's hard to know where to look. A few fat, friendly dogs wander in and out. On the front porch, Larry Wilson takes a drag from his cigarette.
You get a cross mix of people here you ain't gonna believe. You know, you'll get cowboys, old hippies, bikers.
Wilson lives in nearby Spring Valley and has only been coming here a few years since his sister began tending bar. But the area brings back memories of his childhood when his family would drive from their home in Sunny Slope to explore these mountains in their 54 Chevy station wagon. Wilson says places like Cleater, and there aren't many, are important.
Because we've lost touch of our past. You know, and this is, I forget what year this is made, but it's been here forever.
The community is a dot in the foothills of the Bradshaw Mountains that began in the late 1800s as Turkey Creek. It later became Cleater, after the man who bought the town named it after himself. Mining camps used to be nearby, and train tracks once ran through town. But now, with a population that hovers around 11, Cleater doesn't have much to draw people, except for a country store, and the bar, of course. That's what brought Harmony Laughlin here. She says a few years ago, one of the bartenders had a little bit too much to drink.
I was like, oh, bartender, are you sure? You know, go sleep on the couch, no problem. And then I just kind of got a little job here in the community, and I got to meet all the ranchers and became good friends with them. So they liked me, and they kept me here.
So at 26, Laughlin moved to Cleater in an RV and lived off the grid without water or electricity for 2 years. She now lives a few miles up the mountain, but still works at the bar and still feels completely embraced by the locals. Here, they take care of each other, she says.
If you're out of firewood, if you're out of propane, if you need cash, like, we will find a way.
But this sense of community isn't just for residents. Mike Pittman has been coming to Cleater for 40 years. Sporting dark shades and a ZZ Top beard, he says this tiny bar and this tiny town are here for everyone.
We will make you welcome here. I don't care what you are, who you are, where you're from. If you want to stop and have a beer, you're in. You will fit in.
As long as you like your beer in cans, the only way you can get it here. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Cleater.
There's a dusty stretch of rural houses in central Scottsdale, just a mile or so from Scottsdale Fashion Square. They may not seem to fit with the general perception of the city, but for nearly seven decades, it's been the creative space for some of Arizona's most influential artists. The place is known as Cattle Track. An exhibit opens tonight at the Larson Gallery in Scottsdale called Cattle Track Legends. It features the work of Fritz Scholder, Philip C. Curtis, and Mark McDowell. I met McDowell and gallery owner Polly Larson at Cattle Track to learn more about its legacy. We began by talking about what Scholder's art is best known for.
A lot of collectors like his early 1970s works. They were very iconic at the time because he was really the first artist to take the Native American out of kind of a romanticized element and make him real. One of his most famous paintings is Indians sitting up at a bar with the Coors can. And so it was kind of the first time that had been done, and it was very shocking. So a lot of people associate Fritz with that Native American work, but he's done a lot of other series since then. And we, in our exhibition, have works from our earliest one, I think, is 1968, all the way up to 2001. In regards to Philip Curtis, when we look at him, we think of magic realism. Kind of a little bit of surrealism, but really magic realism. To think that Phil was living in the desert this whole time that he was creating his work, and a lot of them are Victorian. They look like their works from the early 1900s. Very out of context with being in the desert, except for a lot of the landscapes are very barren. And Mark might be able to give a little bit more insight into that as well, because he knew Phil's work very well.
Rudy Turk, longtime director at the museum, who would have been instrumental when Phil was coming up, had said that Phil's paintings were void of people. You could hear the wind blow. And sometimes looking out in that desert outside of the golf courses and the development, that is what it is. It's the wind and the creosote, and it is sort of surreal.
People are going to hear this, and they're going to be surprised a little bit. They're going to say, wow, okay, so not that far from Scottsdale Fashion Square, there's this arts colony where these great artists have created and are still creating now. Can you describe for us just pulling into this area and then coming back to the workspace?
Well, and the first thing is it looks rural, certainly by desert standards. Nothing real bright and shiny. Mostly pretty weathered, and that weathered is honest weather. You know, this family has been here from the early days of Arizona. And I think because it was important to keep this from being overly developed or paved over or made into a golf course, the fact that there were artists and craftsmen and artisans here and gave it a different purpose. And it's remained. You know, there are sometimes people come down the driveway and I think they feel we made it look like this sort of some Hollywood trick. You know, this is what it looks like. So, you know, it's not rawhide. So I think it's welcoming. I think people are a little surprised. You know, we're in Scottsdale. Actually, Scottsdale grew around this. This was here before there was a Scottsdale. I think that has a real, you know, honest appeal to people. It feels sort of homey.
Is there a generational connection? We think about Philip Curtis starting in the 40s and then Fritz Scholder in the, what, around 1970 or so?
Absolutely.
And then you a little bit later. Can you give us some link to what attracted you to feel like this was a place that you wanted to do your art and you wanted to sell? What was the vibe you were getting from it? And did you feel like there was a legacy here then?
What I saw was a place where Well, first of all, you said there's some studio space for an artist. You know, typically in older cities, there are loft spaces, there are rundown warehouses, there are places where artists can inhabit and do their work. Artists don't have a lot of money. They need a place to work. And so that's where it falls in most cities. In Scottsdale, you know, there's hardly anything. So just the fact that there's an old barn down this dusty driveway and they're willing to let it to an artist is, you know, that was almost enough.
You know, now that we're out in the open area, is this still a place they could build legends, you think, Markham? Is this a place that would that word still apply here?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And for generations to come, we hope it's an incubator of that sort of thing. And, you know, the more you're around here and you see families and young people and you realize there's a whole generation or two behind us. So that's what we have to figure out what to do next is how to keep it going into another generation.
Artist Mark McDowell and Polly Larson of the Larson Gallery, which will be hosting an exhibit called Cattle Track Legends beginning tonight. To get a deeper perspective on the art of Fritz Schulder and Philip C. Curtis, I called Jerry Smith, former curator for European, American, and Western art at the Phoenix Art Museum. Jerry, as someone who has studied Schulder's art, what stands out about it?
I feel that Fritz Schulder's paintings and his printmaking and everything else he made really questioned the stereotypes, the romantic cliches that are so often found in Western American art. He really did make a stand on that questioning of the stereotypes that's so prominent in much Western American art.
Now, Philip C. Curtis, anyone who would have been to the Phoenix Art Museum knows something about him, but he was someone who was doing his work in Arizona as early as the 1940s.
Yeah, Philip Curtis is a fascinating figure. His work, I feel, fits in nicely, very nicely, with so much of 20th century art, American art, that deals with kind of ideas of isolation and the angst of the modern times. Think of the isolated figures of Edward Hopper, odd, kind of a Victorian dressed, so they're not just a timely, you don't look at them and think, oh, 1960s, but they're Victorian dressed figures in these rather odd, isolated, surrealist settings. And I think they're really quite remarkable works. And I think the big open landscape that you find in the American desert in Arizona, you find in his work as well.
What is a setting like something like Cattle Track and its uniqueness, what does that do for sort of the creative outlet for a painter? Does it make sense to you that Curtis and Schulder would have created at the same place even in such distinctive ways?
Absolutely. Arizona is an open space and allows people the freedom. And this, I think, allows a little more freedom and relaxation to be yourself. And Fritz Schulder, driving his Rolls Royce around Scottsdale, he was a bigger-than-life character. Philip Curtis was a quiet gentleman. Arizona allows that. Cattle Track allows that.
Jerry Smith, former curator for European, American, and Western art at the Phoenix Art Museum.
And now it's time for The Quiz Show.
That's when we bring back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quizmaster, who's won a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia, hosted by our producer, Sarah Ventry. This week, he's playing KJZZ reporter Will Stone. Last week, we gave you a puzzle to solve and randomly selected two correct entries. The puzzle was...
Stay with me here now. On my way to California, I saw a man with seven kids. Each kid had seven sacks. Each sack had seven cats. Each cat had seven kittens. Kittens, cats, sacks, kids. How many were going to California? The answer is just one, me. I was the only one going to California. Our randomly selected winners this week are Jennifer Josephson and Drew Gibson. Leszek will play on behalf of Jennifer, and Will will play on behalf of Drew. Whoever wins gets a special KJZZ item.
Leszek, what pop star will perform a David Bowie tribute at the Grammy Awards this year? Is it Adele, Lady Gaga, or Miley Cyrus?
Oh, I don't know this, but based on those three artists, I would guess
Lady Gaga.
You are you are correct, and Will is just, I wish you could see his face. He's just wincing.
Pained, yeah.
Yeah, he clearly knew. He clearly knew. It's okay, Will. We have a pop culture question for you, too.
Bieber related, maybe? No.
Not this time, Will. In the new FX miniseries, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, which actor from Friends plays O.J. Simpson's lawyer, Robert Kardashian? Is it Matthew Perry, Matt LeBlanc, or David Schwimmer?
Wow. I can't imagine Joey playing the lawyer. I got to go with the third, Schwimmer.
You are correct.
He has an attorney look to him.
An attorney look, yeah. All right, it's 1-1. You guys are tied up. Leszek. Mm-hmm. The first part of this month, 5 planets are visible across the early morning sky. Which of the following is not one of the 5 planets that is visible? Is it Neptune, Venus, or Mercury?
Boy, you're asking this question of a guy who was an astronomy major in college. Neptune is the planet.
You are right. Wait, did you know that because you knew that right now it wasn't visible, or is there some scientific reason why it would never be visible?
Neptune is, the brightest it gets is magnitude 8, and the brightest star any human can see is about magnitude 7 or so. So it's just not visible to the naked eye under any circumstances.
Wow.
He knew the scientific underpinnings.
Well, clearly I didn't when I wrote the question. I just picked a planet that wasn't on the list. Okay, Will, what human organ did scientists at Harvard recently 3D print? Is it an adult heart, a child liver, or a baby brain?
Wow. A baby brain, that seems a little too involved. I think I would have heard of that. I'm going to go the liver.
It's actually the baby brain.
What?
Yeah. Evidently, they're trying to understand the twisty, bendy folds that are found in a healthy brain.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
So the Super Bowl was on Sunday, and one of my favorite things about that day is all of the prop bets that can be made. Which of the following is not a bet that could be made on this year's Super Bowl? Is it... what color will Beyoncé's footwear be when she comes on stage for the halftime show? How many times will Cam Newton do the open shirt Superman motion during the game? Or what will the temperature of the Gatorade be when it's poured over the winning coach?
Ooh, this is just a complete guess. Beyoncé's shoes.
No, Beyoncé's shoes you can totally bet on. Will is throwing his arms in the air like he just
relief.
Made a touchdown. Okay. Yes. Actually, the only thing you can't bet on is the temperature of the Gatorade that is poured on the coach. Okay. So, Will, if you get this question right, you can tie things up and force it to a tiebreaker. So, Will, speaking of the Super Bowl, lots of people are thinking about the very first Super Bowl since this is Super Bowl 50 this year. One man believes he has the closest thing to a full recording of the game, and he tried to sell it to the NFL for $1 million. The deal did not go through, though, because the NFL did not counteroffer him enough. How much did they counteroffer him? Was it $100,000, $50,000, or $30,000?
Well, I'm going to say 30 just seems too low for the
to counter
original,
a million.
Yeah, to counter a million. So I'm going to go high with it, 100,000.
They counteroffered $30,000.
Ah. Oh.
Yeah.
Cheapos.
Yeah, I know. So that means Leszek.
Good.
Leszek, you are still the champ.
Yay.
Well played, Leszek.
Thank you, sir.
Congratulations to this week's winner, Jennifer Josephson. We'll keep bringing Leszek back, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle and your chance to be one of our at-home players.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.